it by giving it something to do. Tell a story in a way that elicits a second story from the little voice. In addition to creating buy-in, springboard stories mobilize people to act. Stories focus people on potential solutions. Telling stories with visible goals and barriers shifts the audience into a problem-solving mode. Clearly, the amount of problem-solving we do varies across stories. We don't watch Titanic and start brainstorming about improved iceberg spotting systems. But we do empathize with the main characters and start cheering them on when they confront their problems. Look out behind you. Tell them off now. Don't open that door. But springboard stories go beyond having us problem solve for the main character. A springboard story helps us problem solve for ourselves. A springboard story is an exercise in mass customization. Each audience member uses the story as a springboard to slightly different destinations. After Denning told the Zambia story, one of the executives at the meeting took the idea of knowledge management to the president of the World Bank, arguing that it was the future of the organization. Denning was invited to present his ideas to the bank's top leaders, including the president. By the end of the year, the president had announced that knowledge management was one of the bank's top priorities. The Conference Storybook. We started the chapter with the nurse story, which comes from the researcher Gary Klein. Klein tells another story that provides a good summary of the ground we covered. The organizer of a conference once asked Klein's firm to sum up the results of a conference. The organizer wanted a useful summary of the conference, more compact than a transcript and more coherent than an idiosyncratic collection of the presenter's PowerPoint slides. Klein's firm assigned one person to monitor each of the conference's five parallel tracks. The monitors attended each panel, and each time someone told a story, they jotted it down. At the end of the conference, the monitors compared notes and found that, as Klein said, they had compiled a set of stories that were funny and tragic and exciting. The group structured and organized the stories and sent the packet to the conference organizer. She was ecstatic. She found the packet much more vivid and useful than the typical conference takeaway, a set of dry, jargon-filled abstracts. She even requested funds from her organization to convert the notes into a book. Meanwhile, as a courtesy, she sent the summary notes to all of the conference presenters. They were furious. They were insulted to have the stories scooped out of their overall structure. They didn't want to be remembered as people who told a bunch of stories and anecdotes. They felt that they'd invested countless hours into distilling their experiences into a series of recommendations. Indeed, their abstracts, which had been submitted to the conference organizers, were filled with tidbits of wisdom, such as, keep the lines of communication open, and don't wait too long when problems are building up. Klein said, we want to explain to them how meaningless these slogans are in contrast to stories, such as the one that showed how they had kept the lines of communication open during a difficult incident in which a plant was shut down. But the presenters were adamant, and the project was abandoned. This story is one of our favorites in the book because the dynamics are so clear. We're not trying to portray the presenters as bad, idea-hating people. Put yourself in their shoes. You've created this amazing presentation, summarizing years of your work, and your goal is to help people master a complex structure that you've spent years constructing. You've erected an amazing intellectual edifice. Then, Klein's crew approaches your edifice, plucks a few bricks out of the wall, and tries to pass them off as the sum of all your labors. The nerve! The problem, of course, is that it's impossible to transfer an edifice in a 90-minute presentation. The best you can do is convey some building blocks, but you can't pluck the building blocks from the roof, which is exactly what you're doing with a recommendation like, keep the lines of communication open. Suppose you're a manager at Nordstrom, addressing a conference of your peers. The final slide in your presentation might read, lessons from Nordstrom. In retail, outstanding customer service is a key source of competitive advantage. While discussing your fourth slide, you might have mentioned, as a humorous aside, the Nordy who gift-wrapped a present bought at Macy's. These jokers from Klein's firm want to keep your gift-wrapping story but drop your punchline. And they're absolutely right. In the simple and unexpected chapters, we said that good messages must move from common sense to uncommon sense. In contrast, there's nothing but common sense in recommendations such as keep the lines of communication open and don't wait too long when problems are building up. Klein comments that these lessons are presumably designed for people who would rather close lines of communication and sit around when they're facing a daunting problem. Once again, the curse of knowledge has bewitched these presenters. When they share their lessons, keep the lines of communication open, they're hearing a song filled with passion and emotion inside their heads. They're remembering the experiences that taught them those lessons, the struggles, the political battles, the missteps, the pain. They are tapping. But they forget that the audience can't hear the same tune they hear. Stories can almost single-handedly defeat the curse of knowledge. In fact, they naturally embody most of the success framework. Stories are almost always concrete. Most of them have emotional and unexpected elements. The hardest part of using stories effectively is making sure that they're simple, that they reflect your core message. It's not enough to tell a great story. The story has to reflect your agenda. You don't want a general lining up his troops before battle to tell a connection plot story. Stories have the amazing dual power to simulate and to inspire, and most of the time we don't even have to use much creativity to harness these powers. We just need to be ready to spot the good ones that life generates every day. Epilogue. What sticks? Sometimes ideas stick despite our best efforts to stop them. In 1946, Leo Durocher was the coach of the Dodgers. His club was leading the National League, while the team's traditional arch rival, the New York Giants, was languishing in the bottom of the standings. During a game between the Dodgers and the Giants, Durocher was mocking the Giants in front of a group of sports writers. One of the sports writers teased Durocher, "Why don't you be a nice guy for a change?" Durocher pointed at the Giants' dugout and said, "Nice guys, look over there. Do you know a nicer guy than Giants manager Mel Ott? Or any of the other Giants? Why, they're the nicest guys in the world. And where are they? In seventh place." As recounted by Ralph Keyes in his book on misquotations, "Nice guys finish seventh," the metamorphosis of Durocher's quote began a year later. The Baseball Digest quoted Durocher as saying, "Nice guys finish in last place in the second division." Before long, as his quip was passed along from one person to another, it evolved, becoming simpler and more universal, until it emerged as a cynical comment on life. "Nice guys finish last." No more reference to the Giants. No more reference to seventh place. In fact, no more reference to baseball at all. "Nice guys finish last." This quote, polished by the marketplace of ideas, irked Durocher. For years he denied saying the phrase, and of course he was right. But eventually he gave up. "Nice guys finish last" was the title of his autobiography. One of the most famous misquotations of all time is attributed to the fictional detective Sherlock Holmes. Holmes never said, "Elementary, my dear Watson." This seems hard to believe. The quote is perfectly suited to our schema of Holmes. In fact, if you asked someone to name one Sherlock Holmes quote, this would be it. His most famous quote is the one he never said. Why did this non-existent quote stick? It's not hard to imagine what must have happened. Holmes frequently said, "My dear Watson," and he often said, "Elementary." A natural mistake, for someone inclined to quote from a Holmes mystery, would be to combine the two. And, like an adaptive biological mutation, the newly combined quote was such an improvement that it couldn't help but spread. This four-word quotation, after all, contains the essence of Holmes, the brilliant detective never too busy to condescend to his faithful sidekick. In the simple chapter, we told the story of the 1992 Clinton campaign and Carville's famous proverb, "It's the economy, stupid." We mentioned that this proverb was one of three phrases that Carville wrote on a whiteboard. Here's a trivia question. What were the other two? The other two phrases were change versus more of the same and don't forget health care. Those phrases didn't stick. So, should Carville have been pleased with the success of "It's the economy, stupid" as an idea? On the one hand, his phrase resonated so strongly that it became a powerful tool in framing the election. On the other hand, he got only one-third of his message across. We bring up these examples because in making ideas stick, the audience gets a vote. The audience may change the meaning of your idea, as happened with DeRocher. The audience may actually improve your idea, as was the case with Sherlock Holmes. Or the audience may retain some of your ideas and jettison others, as with Carville. All of us tend to have a lot of idea pride. We want our message to endure in the form we designed. DeRocher's response when the audience shaped his idea was to deny, 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 then eventually accept. The question we have to ask ourselves in any situation is this: is the audience's version of my message still core? In Chapter 1, Simple, we discuss the importance of focusing on core messages, honing in on the most important truths that we need to communicate. If the world takes our ideas and changes them, or accepts some and discards others, all we need to decide is whether the mutated versions are still core. If they are, as with "It's the economy, stupid," then we should humbly embrace the audience's judgment. Ultimately, the test of our success as idea creators isn't whether people mimic our exact words. It's whether we achieve our goals. The power of spotting. Carville, DeRocher, and Arthur Conan Doyle were all creators of ideas. They produced ideas from scratch. But let's not forget that it's just as effective to spot sticky ideas as it is to create them. Think about Nordstrom. You can't very well create from scratch a bunch of stories about sales reps cheerfully gift-wrapping presents from Macy's. But when you come across a real story like that, you've got to be alert to the idea's potential. And this isn't as easy as it sounds. The barrier to idea spotting is that we tend to process anecdotes differently than abstractions. If a Nordstrom manager is hit with an abstraction, such as "increased customer satisfaction scores by 10% this quarter," that abstraction kicks in the managerial mentality. How do we get there from here? But a story about a tire chain exchanging cold car warming sales rep provokes a different way of thinking. It will likely be filed away with other kinds of day-to-day personal news, interesting but ultimately trivial, like the fact that John Robison shaved his head or James Sloiter showed up late 7 days in a row. In some sense, there's a wall in our minds separating the little picture, stories for instance, from the big picture. Spotting requires us to tear down that wall. How do we tear down the wall? As a rough analogy, think about the way we buy gifts for loved ones. If we know that Christmas or a birthday is approaching, there's a little nagging process that opens up in our minds, reminding us that Dad is a gadget guy, so keep an eye out for cool gadgets. It's barely conscious, but if we happen upon a retractable roto laser light on December 8th, chances are we'll immediately spot it as a possible fit for Dad. The analogy to the idea world is maintaining a deeply ingrained sense of the core message that we want to communicate. Just as we can put on Dad gift glasses, allowing us to view merchandise from his perspective, we can also put on core idea glasses, allowing us to filter incoming ideas from that perspective. If you're a Nordstrom manager, obsessed with improving customer service, this filter helps you spot the warming cars episode as a symbol of perfection, rather than as an interesting anecdote. In the introduction, we debunked the common assumption that you need natural creative genius to cook up a great idea. You don't. But beyond that, it's crucial to realize that creation, period, is unnecessary. Think of the ideas in this book that were spotted rather than created. Nordys, Jared, The Mystery of Saturn's Rings, Pam Laffin, the smoking anti-authority, the nurse who ignored the heart monitor, listened with her stethoscope, and saved the baby's life. If you're a great spotter, you'll always trump a great creator. Why? Because the world will always produce more great ideas than any single individual, even the most creative one. The Speakers and the Stickers. Each year in the second session of CHIP's Making Ideas Stick class at Stanford, the students participate in an exercise, a kind of testable credential to show what kinds of messages stick and don't stick. The students are given some data from a government source on crime patterns in the United States. Half of them are asked to make a 1-minute persuasive speech to convince their peers that nonviolent crime is a serious problem in this country. The other half are asked to take the position that it's not particularly serious. Stanford students, as you'd expect, are smart. They also tend to be quick thinkers and good communicators. No one in the room ever gives a poor speech. The students divide into small groups, and each one gives a 1-minute speech while the others listen. After each speech, the listeners rate the speaker. How impressive was the delivery? How persuasive? What happens invariably is that the most polished speakers get the highest ratings. Students who are poised, smooth, and charismatic are rated at the top of the class. No surprise, right? Good speakers score well in speaking contests. The surprise comes next. The exercise appears to be over. In fact, Chip often plays a brief Monty Python clip to kill a few minutes and distract the students. And then abruptly, he asks them to pull out a sheet of paper and write down for each speaker they heard every single idea that they remember. The students are flabbergasted at how little they remember. Keep in mind that only 10 minutes have elapsed since the speeches were given. Nor was there a huge volume of information to begin with. At most, they've heard 8 1-minute speeches, and yet the students are lucky to recall 1 or 2 ideas from each speaker's presentation. Many draw a complete blank on some speeches, unable to remember a single concept. In the average 1-minute speech, the typical student uses 2.5 statistics. Only 1 student in 10 tells a story. Those are the speaking statistics. The remembering statistics, on the other hand, are almost a mirror image. When students are asked to recall the speeches, 63% remember the stories. Only 5% remember any individual statistic. Furthermore, almost no correlation emerges between speaking talent and the ability to make ideas stick. The people who were captivating speakers typically do no better than others in making their ideas stick. Foreign students, whose less polished English often leaves them at the bottom of the speaking skills rankings, are suddenly on a par with native speakers. The stars of stickiness are the students who made their case by telling stories, or by tapping into emotion, or by stressing a single point rather than 10. There is no question that a ringer, a student who came into the exercise having read this book, would squash the other students. A community college student for whom English is a second language could easily outperform unwitting Stanford graduate students. Why can't these smart, talented speakers make their ideas stick? A few of the villains discussed in this book are implicated. The first villain is the natural tendency to bury the lead, to get lost in a sea of information. One of the worst things about knowing a lot or having access to a lot of information is that we're tempted to share it all. High school teachers will tell you that when students write research papers, they feel obligated to include every unearthed fact, as though the value were in the quantity of data amassed rather than in its purpose or clarity. Stripping out information in order to focus on the core is not instinctual. The second villain is the tendency to focus on the presentation rather than on the message. Public speakers naturally want to appear composed, charismatic, and motivational. And certainly, charisma will help a properly designed message stick better. But all the charisma in the world won't save a dense, unfocused speech, as some Stanford students learn the hard way. More villains. There are two other key villains in the book that the Stanford students don't have to wrestle with. The first is decision paralysis, the anxiety and irrationality that can emerge from excessive choice or ambiguous situations. Think about the students who missed both a fantastic lecture and a great film because they couldn't decide which one was better, or how hard it was for Jeff Hawkins, the leader of the Palm Pilot Development Group, to get his team to focus on a few issues rather than on many. To beat decision paralysis, communicators have to do the hard work of finding the core. Lawyers must stress one or two points in their closing arguments, not 10. A teacher's lesson plans may contain 50 concepts to share with her students, but in order to be effective, that teacher must devote most of her efforts to making the most critical 2 or 3 stick. Managers must share proverbs, names, names, and names, or the low-fare airline, that help employees wring decisions out of ambiguous situations. The arch-villain of sticky ideas, as you know by now, is the curse of knowledge. The Stanford students didn't face the curse of knowledge because the data on crime was brand new to them. They were more akin to reporters trying to avoid burying the lead on a news story than to experts who have forgotten what it's like not to know something. The curse of knowledge is a worthy adversary because, in some sense, it's inevitable. Getting a message across has two stages, the answer stage and the telling others stage. In the answer stage, you use your expertise to arrive at the idea that you want to share. Doctors study for a decade to be capable of giving the answer. Business managers may deliberate for months to arrive at the answer. Here's the rub. The same factors that work to your advantage in the answer stage will backfire on you during the telling others stage. To get the answer, you need expertise, but you can't dissociate expertise from the curse of knowledge. You know things that others don't know, and you can't remember what it was like not to know those things. So when you get around to sharing the answer, you'll tend to communicate as if your audience were you. You'll stress the scads of statistics that were pivotal in arriving at the answer. And like the Stanford students, you'll find that no one remembers them afterward. You'll share the punchline, the overarching truth that emerged from months of study and analysis. And like the CEO who stresses maximizing shareholder value to his frontline employees, no one will have a clue how your punchline relates to the day-to-day work. There is a curious disconnect between the amount of time we invest in training people how to arrive at the answer and the amount of time we invest in training them how to tell others. It's easy to graduate from medical school or an MBA program without ever taking a class in communication. College professors take dozens of courses in their areas of expertise, but none on how to teach. A lot of engineers would scoff at a training program about telling others. Business managers seem to believe that once they've clicked through a PowerPoint presentation showcasing their conclusions, they've successfully communicated their ideas. What they've done is shared data. If they're good speakers, they may even have created an enhanced sense among their employees and peers that they are decisive or managerial or motivational. But, like the Stanford students, the surprise will come when they realize that nothing they've said had impact. They've shared data, but they haven't created ideas that are useful and lasting. Nothing stuck. Making an idea stick, the communication framework. For an idea to stick, for it to be useful and lasting, it's got to make the audience, one, pay attention. 2, understand and remember it. 3, agree, believe. 4, care. 5, be able to act on it. This book could have been organized around these 5 steps, but there's a reason they were reserved for the conclusion. The curse of knowledge can easily render this framework useless. When an expert asks, "Will people understand my idea?" her answer will be, "Yes, because she herself understands." Of course, my people will understand maximizing shareholder value. When an expert asks, "Will people care about this?" her answer will be, "Yes, because she herself cares." Think of the Murray Dranoff duo piano people who said, "We exist to protect, preserve, and promote the music of the duo piano." They were shocked when that statement didn't arouse the same passion in others that it did in them. The success checklist is a substitute for the framework above, and its advantage is that it's more tangible and less subject to the curse of knowledge. In fact, if you think back across the chapters you've read, you'll notice that the framework matches up nicely. 1. Pay attention. Unexpected. 2. Understand and remember it. Concrete. 3. Agree, believe. Credible. 4. Care. Emotional. 5. Be able to act on it. Story. So rather than guess about whether people will understand our ideas, we should ask, is it concrete? Rather than speculate about whether people will care, we should ask, is it emotional? Does it get out of Maslow's basement? Does it force people to put on an analytical hat or allow them to feel empathy? By the way, simple is not on the list above because it's mainly about the answer stage, honing in on the core of your message and making it as compact as possible. But simple messages help throughout the process, especially in helping people to understand and act. The success checklist, then, is an ideal tool for dealing with communication problems. Let's look at some common symptoms of communication problems and how we can respond to them. Symptoms and solutions. Problems getting people to pay attention to a message. Symptom: no one is listening to me. Or, they seem bored. They hear this stuff all the time. Solution: surprise them by breaking their guessing machines. Tell them something that is uncommon sense. The lead is, there will be no school next Thursday. Nordy's gift wrap packages from Macy's. Symptom: I lost them halfway through. Or, their attention was wavering toward the end. Solution: create curiosity gaps. Tell people just enough for them to realize the piece that's missing from their knowledge. Remember Rune Arledge's introductions to college football games, setting the context for the rivalry. Or create mysteries or puzzles that are slowly solved over the course of the communication, like the professor who started each class with a mystery, such as the one about Saturn's rings. Problems getting people to understand and remember. Symptom: they always nod their heads when I explain it to them, but it never seems to translate into action. Solution: make the message simpler and use concrete language. Use what people already know as a way to make your intentions clearer, as with a generative analogy, like Disney's cast member metaphor. Or use concrete, real-world examples. Don't talk about knowledge management. Tell a story about a health worker in Zambia getting information on malaria from the Internet. Symptom: we have these meetings where it seems like everyone is talking past each other. Or, everyone has such different levels of knowledge that it's hard to teach them. Solution: create a highly concrete turf where people can apply their knowledge. Think of the venture capital pitch for a portable computer where the entrepreneur tossed his binder onto the table, sparking brainstorming. Have people grapple with specific examples or cases rather than concepts. Problems getting people to believe you or agree. Symptom: they're not buying it. Solution: Find the telling details for your message. The equivalent of the dancing 73-year-old man, or the textile factory so environmentally friendly that it actually cleans the water pouring through it. Use fewer authorities and more anti-authorities. Symptom: they quibble with everything I say. Or, I spend all my time arguing with them about this. Solution: quiet the audience's mental skeptics by using a springboard story, switching them into creative mode. Move away from statistics and facts toward meaningful examples. Use an anecdote that passes the Sinatra test. Problems getting people to care. Symptom: they are so apathetic. Or, no one seems fired up about this. Solution: remember the Mother Teresa effect. People care more about individuals than they do about abstractions. Tell them an inspiring challenge plot or creativity plot story. Tap into their sense of their own identities, like the Don't Mess with Texas ads, which suggested that not littering was the Texan thing to do. Symptom: the things that used to get people excited just aren't doing it anymore. Solution: get out of Maslow's basement and try appealing to more profound types of self-interest. Problems getting people to act. Symptom: everyone nods their heads and then nothing happens. Solution: inspire them with a challenge plot story. Jared, David and Goliath. Or engage them by using a springboard story. The World Bank. Make sure your message is simple and concrete enough to be useful. Turn it into a proverb. Names, names, and names. John F. Kennedy versus Floyd Lee. I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth. Those were John F. Kennedy's words in May 1961. An inspiring message for an inspiring mission. It was a single idea that motivated a nation to a decade of work, an eventual, historic, unforgettable success. But here's the thing. You're not JFK, and neither are we. We don't have an ounce of his charisma or power. We are less concerned with traveling to the moon than with, say, remembering our wallets when we leave home in the morning. So if being JFK was what it took to make an idea stick, this would be a depressing book indeed. JFK isn't the standard. In fact, he's the aberration. Keep in mind that the same chapter where we first mentioned the Man on the Moon speech also contains a reference to the Kentucky Fried Rat. Our heads are not entirely in the clouds. Sticky ideas have things in common, and in this book, we've reverse-engineered them. We've studied preposterous ideas, the kidney thieves and their ice-filled bathtub. We've studied brilliant ideas. Ulcers are caused by bacteria. We've studied boring ideas made interesting, the flight safety announcement. We've studied interesting ideas made boring, oral rehydration salts that could save the lives of thousands of kids. We've seen ideas related to newspapers, accounting, nuclear war, evangelism, seatbelts, dust, dancing, litter, football, AIDS, shipping, and hamburgers. And what we've seen is that all these ideas, profound and mundane, serious and silly, share common traits. Our hope is that now that you understand these traits, you'll be able to apply them to your own ideas. They laughed when you shared a story instead of a statistic, but when the idea stuck. The success checklist is intended to be a deeply practical tool. It's no accident that it's a checklist and not an equation. It's not hard and it's not rocket science, but neither is it natural or instinctive. It requires diligence and it requires awareness. This book is filled with normal people facing normal problems who did amazing things simply by applying these principles, even if they weren't aware that they were doing it. These people are so normal that you probably won't even recognize their names when you see them. Their names aren't sticky, but their stories are. There was Art Silverman. He was the guy who stopped a nation from eating obscenely unhealthy movie popcorn. He laid out a full day's worth of fatty foods next to a tub of popcorn and said, "This is how much saturated fat is in this snack." A normal person with a normal job who made a difference. There was Nora Ephron's journalism teacher. Poor guy, we didn't even mention his name. He told his class, "The lead is, there will be no school next Thursday." And in that one sentence, he rewrote his students' image of journalism. He inspired Ephron, and doubtless many others, to become journalists. A normal person with a normal job who made a difference. And what about Bob Otsuya? No chance you remember his name. He's the Subway franchise owner who served sandwiches to a fat guy every day and spotted a great story in the making. Because of Otsuya, the hugely successful Jared campaign was discovered and launched. A normal person with a normal job who made a difference. Then there was Floyd Lee, the leader of the Pegasus Mess Hall in Iraq. He defined his role as being about morale, not food service. He got the same supplies as everyone else, but soldiers flocked to his tent and his pastry chef started describing her desserts as sensual. A normal person with a normal job who made a difference. And there was Jane Elliott. Her classroom simulation of racial prejudice is still etched in the minds of her students more than 20 years later. It's not a stretch to say that she came up with an idea that prevented prejudice, like a vaccine. A normal person with a normal job who made a difference. All these people distinguished themselves by crafting ideas that made a difference. They didn't have power or celebrity or PR firms or advertising dollars or spinmeisters. All they had were ideas. And that's the great thing about the world of ideas. Any of us, with the right insight and the right message, can make an idea stick. This is Charles Kallenberg. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Made to Stick, Why Some Ideas Survive and Others Die, by Chip Heath and Dan Heath. This program was produced and directed by Sean Runette. Executive producer Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2007 by Chip Heath and Dan Heath. Production copyright 2007 Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.